All righty, we will continue into our second hour. So we left off finishing with the verses and the thoughts, there will be no more stranger, no more Canaanite in the land, we're in the house of God. Now as we look at, as we mentioned in the slide behind us here, Nehemiah would face three entrenched enemies, Sanballat, the Moabite, even though you'll see that he's referred to as the governor of Samaria. I think the Moabite is really, if you want to trace back his origins, especially as regards the thought here from a couple of commentaries, I think that's a safe attachment to put him in. And it fits in with the overall theme. Sanballat, the Moabite, and Tobiah, the Ammonite, and Geshem would be the Arabian. As this slide also shows, we could identify three specific enemies, of course not the only ones, but that oppose Christ as well. Pharisees predominantly, scribes also, and Sadducees as well. We also know that there were three primary, though not the only in his life, but three primary types of temptation in the wilderness. And so this three has a kind of a complete sense to it. The opposition that Nehemiah would face manifested in these two principal enemies. Geshem, of course, is mentioned less, but of course is confederate in with this opposition. And these two principal enemies represent a host of wicked and profane things, and it's very much typed or likened to the opposition that's inherent in the flesh. And I've put that up here for us to kind of look at. The response that Nehemiah would get to his charter and his commission would manifest really in these ways. And we've called out these six, which is, of course, representative of the flesh. At first, and we're going to see this from Nehemiah chapter 4 here in just a second, the enemies of Nehemiah would respond with grief and mourning and resentment. What are you doing here, basically, to thwart our power, our influence, disrupt our very comfortable way of life, so to speak, in ruling over these people or having our way? Then it would come to ridicule, to belittle Nehemiah, to try to reduce or to discredit his commission. Then it would come out, and next would come into outright intimidation. And we'll see some of the tactics. They're really, when you take a look at these tactics employed by the enemy, they are textbook. They are classic because, of course, they are the inherent wicked characteristics of the flesh. Threats of violence, and to a lesser degree, violent acts. There would be craftiness involved. And, of course, there would be offers of compromise, negotiation. So, grief, as we see in 2:10, was the response. When Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah, the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. We like our influence the way it is. Look at chapter 2:19, or down to verse 19, I should say, for ridicule. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, "What is this thing that ye do or propose to do?" And then also inferring, are you going to really rebel against the king? Are you trying to perform an insurrection? Those similar things were used against Christ, weren't they? Treason, leading an insurrection, sedition is what was accused against Christ. Intimidation, which we'll be looking at here in a second, so I'll save that one. That's in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. And also 7 and 8 is craftiness. If you flip over to chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, we see the compromise. And it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies, so of course there were more, heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, Come, let us meet together in some or one of the villages in the plain of Ono. And they thought to do me mischief. And then lastly, the one we just considered. So back to chapter 4. This is what we'd like to look at. And unfortunately, these tactics are very much alive and well in our day. In chapter 4, we see that the enemy attempted to organize against the efforts of Nehemiah with taunts of mocking and violence. Let's look at verses 1 through 3, and really we're going to look at verses 1 through 8, but first 1 through 3. And it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, What do these feeble Jews, or what are these Jews, what have they just done? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned? Now Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, Even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall. Now this is pretty haughty, taunting language. From their perspective, they're not holding back. They are complete enemies of the work that Nehemiah was doing and in complete opposition to it. Now let's look at Nehemiah's response, because it's a pretty significant response. As the character of Nehemiah, he goes into prayer. Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn their reproach upon their own head, and give them for a prey in the land of captivity. And cover not their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out from before thee, for they have provoked thee to anger before the builders. And also verse 6, here's the action. So built we the wall. And all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work. Nehemiah's leadership, his leading by example, and his willingness to pick up the hammer himself and go to the wall. We don't have time to look at the accounts that he didn't even change his clothes over that 52-day period of rebuilding the wall. The walls were finished in 52 days. The organization of the people in chapter 3, which we'll just take a look at. But he led by example and went forward. In the re-signing of the covenant, Nehemiah chapter 10, he's the first one to sign it. Of course, as I mentioned, who was conspicuously absent? Eliashib, the high priest at that time, would not sign it. Is not mentioned. Now, let's look at verse 7 and 8. And it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. So, we see the mocking of the enemies, typified in the latter-day enemies of Israel. We see the prayer of Nehemiah in response to that. And we see this played out in the prophecies of Joel, that they will be the ones put into captivity, that is, the enemies, after they have put to captivity the sons and daughters of Israel. This will be turned upon their head. Nehemiah, a type of Christ, the antitype or the greater Nehemiah, will accomplish this and will fulfill this and answer this prayer to the latter-day enemies of Israel. But in verse 7 and 8, and specifically 8, we see a word that's called out, and it's to hinder it. And I want to just draw a little attention to this word. First, the question, can we identify the conspiracy or the strategy of the enemies in this word to hinder it? What did they propose to do? What was their opposition going to be? Because it's found in the root of this word hinder. The root word from the Hebrew has the sense for this word hinder. It means to confuse. Now I find this very, very interesting. The enemies realized that outright force would not be successful. The people had a mind to work. They were unified. Nehemiah had also used some very strategic tactics to have them, as we know, very familiar with the story, working while others were on guard simultaneously, and they were focused, they were united. There was not weakness, even though there was attempts along the rebuilding of the wall, various sections, to infuse some sort of breach from the opposition, but they were unsuccessful because the people had a mind to work. They were unified. So you go to tactic two, which is an insidious tactic, which all you have to do to be successful is confuse, and you will pause the work. The enemies realized that outright force would not be successful. The people under Nehemiah, as we mentioned, were too united and had a mind to work. They therefore resorted to a tactic of sowing confusion. And let me attempt to demonstrate here how devastating this tactic can be. When it comes to undermining the truth, and specifically, we'll use this example, the correct interpretation of prophecy, all it takes for the enemy to be successful is to question the continuous historical outline of prophecy. To just inject a little bit of confusion by offering an alternative view, or injecting some measure of doubt. The individual is usually well-liked, personable, and well-educated, can bring forth enough argument to put forward a question mark in the student's mind, a bit of confusion. The individual, or the effect, is devastating because all the tactic has to do to be successful is confuse or hinder the work. And what is that work? The work is the study of the apocalypse or the prophecies of Daniel. You see, if enough conflicting interpretations are left to confuse the student, then the student, if he is young or weak in the truth or early in the truth, will cease the work or the study. In their minds, they see seemingly intelligent brethren disagreeing and conclude that there must not be a clear answer, and I'll put that study on the shelf and study something else where there is agreement. So you see, injecting confusion is all the enemy needs to do to destroy the work. And it's something we have to be on guard against. If this confusion is allowed to permeate fundamental false doctrine or fundamental doctrines, in addition to prophecy, then the effects on the student become life-threatening. Reductio ad absurdum, which means reduction to an absurdity. The truth divides and separates because it is distinct and singular. That's why we call it truth. That's why it is truth. That's why it has power, because it is truth, because it is the Word of God. In order for mass appeal, it must be reduced until it becomes absurd or false or of no life-saving power. Nehemiah's response to this insidious tactic, because it was the tactic of the enemy to hinder it, they couldn't do it outright. They couldn't do it with force or with violence, but they would attempt to do it by injecting confusion, which could hinder the work. Nehemiah's response, look at verse 9. Nevertheless, we made a prayer unto our God and set a watch against them, day and night, because of them. Here's a distinct and very powerful action, to set a watch against them. A guard. Make a prayer and set a watch. Let's compare this with Psalms 141, verses 2 through 3. You know, to be an enemy of the truth is an easy job description. It's a piece of cake. Almost anybody can do it. To defend the truth is hard and takes quite the conviction. The game, as it would seem, is not even. But we are of the latter because that is the only promise. So, verses 2 through 3. Let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense, and the lifting of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth, and keep the door of my lips. This is what we must do as individuals, and this is what we must do as a collective ecclesia. Now, Nehemiah chapter 3 is a wonderful picture of collaboration, a wonderful picture of the ecclesia working together. Their hearts, a mind to work, alignment, unity. It's temporary, but it's a beautiful picture. It's a picture of diverse talents and peoples coming together for the work of the Lord from all different walks of life. We're going to have goldsmiths, jewelers, who work very finely and specifically with their hands, setting their hands to the big rough boulders of a masonry. We're going to have those that work in the very fine work of the apothecary, the perfume, making very specific mixture, also setting their hand to the work. We're going to see men, we're going to see women involved in this work. It is a picture of ecclesial harmony, activity, cooperation, collaboration from brethren of all walks of life at the same time. In addition to the enemy of Sanballat and Tobiah and the constant verbal assaults and threats of violence, they worked in the heat of summer, if you look at the time. And you can see that from Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 3. And in a time of drought. So the worst circumstances, lack of natural water and food, which a drought produces a number of trickle-down effects. And here they are gathered together underneath this very capable type of Christ governor, Nehemiah, and they come together in the work in these very hard circumstances. So the work can be done in the difficult circumstances. And through all this, they completed this work of rebuilding the walls and the gates in 52 days. Some commentaries I found put the people, numbered the people from chapter 3 into 42 groups. Others put the groups of workers at 44. Now, I've looked at it, and depending upon how you group the families, I think there's evidence for either way. I like the idea of 42 groups because we have an interesting connection. There are 42 generations from Abraham to Christ. But again, that needs further study. In chapter 3, verse 1, we have priests and Levites engaged in the work first. And that's for a reason. How appropriate is this order? For to rebuild a people, you must first rebuild and reinstitute the worship and its sacrifices. Nehemiah started with worship first, individually, and the people needed to have this established first. So we have the priests and the Levites mentioned first as their work, and we read there in verse 1, then Eliashib the high priest rose up with his brethren the priests, and they builded the sheep gate. They sanctified it and set up the doors of it, even unto the lower of Mia. They sanctified it under the tower of Hananiel. Now, as the chapter unfolds, we see the men of Jericho involved next in verse 2. And that's interesting for us to consider, men of Jericho rebuilding walls. Of course, we know that Yahweh had cursed the rebuilding of Jericho's walls. No one was supposed to do it. But here we have much like Rahab, the harlot, coming out of Jericho. We have a men of Jericho that, in essence and in the type, come out of their false religion and attach themselves to the hope of Israel and participating in the rebuilding of the wall. We have, as we come down to verse, make a mention, Eliashib was the grandson of Joshua the high priest. So file that away for a moment. At this time, he is giving of himself with his associate priests, as we just read in verse 1. Meshulam, in verse 4, means a friend. He was a great builder, a great worker, and friend of his Jewish brethren. But he was also, unfortunately, compromised by his friendship with Tobiah, as we see later in the book. We see the Gibeonites, or converted Gentiles, engaged in the work in verse 7. And as I let off, we see goldsmiths, jewelers, and fine perfumers putting their hands to the manual labor in verse 8. Unlike the nobles in verse 5, who put not their necks to the work of their Lord. This reminds us of those types, that this was too far below them. This was something of inconvenience, something that they were not willing to literally and spiritually get their hands dirty. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, Not many mighty, not many noble are called. Now, there's a danger more and ever so in this world today that the lure of work, the lure of opportunity, the lure of ease, of wealth, of promotion, of status, of the whole host of things, not many wise are able to come to the truth and give it its work. This is particularly, as men, we are particularly vulnerable to this. Women as well, especially in this day and age. I have seen in my circles the responsibilities. In my world, it's small hospitals. But say, for example, the CEO of a small hospital, he is so busy in that work, from all the departments, from all the after-hours board meetings, from all the Rotary clubs, all the community and the economic development, all of this 7 days a week, how does that man have time to serve on the wall and in the truth? We have to make specific decisions about how we will balance the temporary curse of work, which Solomon says there is fulfillment in doing a good work, and certainly that's our blessing for this day, but making sure that it does not overcome us in the work that is eternal. Now in verse 12 we see Shalom. He and his daughters were engaged in the work. And I wanted to call this out. Here, this is a picture of the layout of the city in Nehemiah's day. So you can see, compared, if you've looked at other maps, and we have some other maps, that it's a more elongated at the bottom there going to the south. So we see the western wall on your left-hand side, and we see the eastern wall in each of its respective parts on your right-hand side. So as you're looking at that, let's think about this. The western wall there, which I have highlighted in verse 12, we see Shalom, he and his daughters engaged in the work. And Shalom, that's a significant portion of the wall that had to be rebuilt, and it's done by Shalom and his daughters. So he was assigned to repair the western wall, the section from the Tower of the Furnaces to the Valley Gate. So while the gates aren't labeled here, you can see this is the same call out in the lower right-hand section of the slide there. I'm going to flip all the way to the end and give us just a little bit of a different view that shows us the different gates. So I don't know if you can see that, but you see at the very bottom of the screen the Valley Gate. And then if you come back up to your left, you see the Tower of Furnaces. That's going to be that western wall section. And so keep that in mind. You can see coming around the Eliashib, and the priest started at the very top, kind of the northeast top there. You see the Sheep Gate. So that's where they began. And as chapter 3 unfolds, we see each section of people assigned to a different section of the wall coming around counterclockwise to finish back up on the eastern side. You see the temple there. So keep that in mind. Look at some of those gates, and we'll go back to our slide. So we see that sisters are a critical part of this ecclesial work. And really, the western wall here was the most vulnerable part of the wall, and it's rebuilt by sisters as it were. And it's a powerful example of the Bride of Christ on probation. We're reminded of the faithful group of women who ministered to the Lord in labor of faith in Mark 15, 40 through 41. And those who labor for the truth was specifically noted by the Apostle Paul in Romans 16, those of sisters. The chapter holds numerous lessons for us to ponder, but for sake of time, we want to move forward and identify a group in verse 26, which is the Nethinim. Of course, Nethinim, just like was read in our lecture evening for Cherubim, needs no S at the end of it, as in Nethinims. because it is already plural, just like cherubim is already plural. It doesn't need cherubims. The Hebrew for Nethinim means one given and is derived from the root word Nathan. We find this obscure group reference in 1 Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah. In 1 Chronicles 9, 1 through 2, we read that they were one of a group of four who were the first to inhabit again their cities after being carried away to Babylon. We can see that in verses 1 through 2 of 1 Chronicles 9. They are an interesting group. For those of us that have studied this topic, our minds are already under the types that they hold. This is a kingdom picture. In Nehemiah chapter 11, verses 20 through 21, we read that these Nethinim dwelt in Ophel, as I've identified here on the screen, or Ophel, just south of the temple, on the southeast side of Temple Mount. The name Ophel means the ascent. And if you can see the stairway depicted here in the on the south side of the temple, you would certainly ascend up. And people coming from afar would ascend through the gates on the south and ascend up to the temple to offer sacrifice. The meaning is this: when people would come up to the temple to worship, it is said that they would ascend to the temple. Let us go up. So for whatever geography, this whole sense, and which will be literally part of the topography, is the common phrase where you go up to the temple itself. In the future, the holy oblation will be dramatically elevated so that the ascent will be obvious to all who approach. In the psalm and the hymn we sing, beautiful for situation is Zion, from Psalm 48, verse 2. Let's go ahead and turn to that, because as you look at the proper definition of situation, it really means elevation. So when we read that, beautiful for situation, the proper rendering is beautiful for elevation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. So the people's minds and hearts were to ascend to the greatness and holiness of Yahweh as they literally ascended to the temple to worship. This ascent would take them through the dwelling place of the Nethinim in Ophel. In Psalm 84, which is in some versions, is entitled a Psalm of Ascent, it is thought to be the song that Israel would sing, or one of the songs that they would sing on approach to the temple. If we go over to Psalm 84, and we look at verse 10, you know, sometimes this verse is quoted that, you know, brethren quote it in an act of humility to say, I would be happy to be a doorkeeper in the house of my God. And that is absolutely true. We absolutely would be. But I think there is a an inference, an allusion here to this Nethinim. As we see here in verse 10 of chapter 84, for a day in thy courts is better than 1,000. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. So here David is drawing out this inference, which we would like to submit, of the Nethinim and their service. Because what is the origin of the Nethinim as we understand it? Well, let's go to Joshua 9, verse 3. They came and craftily, or I believe the word is wily, beguiled Joshua. And they did this for a reason. Of course, they knew, of course, these were the ones that had feigned that they had come from afar, their shoes were worn out, their bread was moldy. As we go to Joshua 9, verse 3, we see this account played out, and then we see after Joshua discovers, because Joshua made a hasty judgment, he did not seek Yahweh's direction first, he made his own decision, and he was beguiled, which is verse 22, and Joshua called for them and spake unto them, saying, wherefore have ye beguiled us, saying, we are very far from you when you dwell among us. Verse 4, earlier in the chapter, or actually verse 3 and 4, and when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and to Ai, they did work wily, or deceitfully, or craftily, and went and made as if they had been ambassadors, and took old sacks upon their asses, and wine bottles, old, and rents, and bound up, in verse 5, and old shoes, and clouted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua unto the camp at Gilgal, and said unto him and to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country. Now therefore make ye a league with us. And of course we know how the story goes. How the Gibeonites beguiled Joshua and Israel to make a covenant with them for their lives, to spare them from death. So there's an interesting lesson right there as well. Not exactly in the same way, but it was in to receive the blessing over Esau. Jacob used a method, but when we analyze what the method he employed to receive that blessing or obtain it, to take it, he is not criticized in that, because he was clinging and going after the hope, the inheritance. And in a lesser example, I would submit the Nethinim are employing a tactic which obviously beguiled Joshua, but it was for life, because they wanted to tether themselves for life and in the greater type to the hope of Israel. In Nethinim, back in Nehemiah 10:28, they're recorded as signers of the covenant. So where Eliashib the high priest could not sign the covenant because he was compromised, we'll see a slide here later, with the enemy, the Nethinim could and did, tying themselves to the hope of Israel. Now, I've already mentioned it, but it is a most notable absentee that the high priest of Israel is not mentioned as signing the covenant in chapter 10 of Nehemiah. Eliashib, the high priest of Israel. Why? Because he was allied to Tobiah the Ammonite, as we see in chapter 13:4. Allied means kinsfolk. And as I've mentioned, he was compromised by marriage to Tobiah's house. What a sad example, the high priest of Israel so compromised through his marriage or relationship to the enemy that he excludes himself from the salvation of Yahweh. We, on the other hand, must commit ourselves to following the example of the Nethinim and bind ourselves to the hope of Israel above all worldly and family relationships that refuse or would oppose the truth. So you see where the Nethinim dwelt in Ophel, and we see that they are, have a blessed place to be able to dwell, and they were to serve as drawers of water and bringers of wood for the service of the priest. So this is a, if you keep this in mind, this is the city of Jerusalem in Nehemiah's day from 325. And again, the same shape of that outline in the lower right-hand part of the screen. Here is modern-day Ophel. So if you look at this notch, the upper right-hand side, right where the stairs go up to the temple, keep that notch in mind. This outer wall is since worn down, but this is a view looking west at the modern-day place of Ophel. Now, we're ready to focus or move in pretty closely here. What time is our second hour end? Okay. So good. We're now ready to focus on our final thoughts this morning, the lessons surrounding Nehemiah 8. We've got a few things to transition before we get into that chapter. So let's recap some of the key developments that brought us here and make mention of a few that we didn't have time to study, obviously, because the book is 13 chapters, and it's full of very in-depth lessons for us to consider. The rebuilding of the walls and the gates are symbolic of the required rebuilding of the nation of Israel, and it rests on the shoulders of a handful of faithful men and women, Nehemiah being the man for the time who we are considering. We considered his character, his courage, his faith and determination, and his deep reverence and dependence upon the Lord God of heaven, his great and terrible God. Upon his arrival, he inspected the broken walls. And this is an account that we did not have time to look at. He goes around the walls at night with himself riding upon an ass. He has a few men associated with him behind him. He goes all the way around. He starts at the northeast and moves his way around the southern tip, around the eastern side, and back up. Makes his inspection, makes his plan, and we have a great type of Christ in that as well. Upon his arrival, he inspected the broken walls, which, as I mentioned, is a type that I would encourage you all to study as it relates to our Lord, stealthily in the dark of night. The literal walls are a metaphor for the people. In the studies of chapter 5 and 6, we see the dire condition of the people. They were borrowing money to pay the king's tribute, taxes, so they were borrowing money to pay taxes. That's the dire strait they were financially. Some had mortgaged their lands, vineyards, and houses just to buy food, to buy corn because of the drought. So you can see loaning against your own property just to buy food, borrowing money just to pay taxes, and all of this, many of this, they were indentured to their own brethren. The burden that their own brethren were putting upon brother upon brother. In short, they were so preoccupied with their own troubles that they forgot the work due to Yahweh, the great king, as it says in Malachi 1:14. And so the problems compounded and the hardship and the debt spiraled out of control. Nehemiah, as a type of Christ, would stand for the oppressed, following the command that he that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God, from 2 Samuel 23:3. And in the law ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor. Leviticus 19:15. And when Nehemiah rebuked them for the sins, the nobles and rulers held their peace and found nothing to answer, as it's recorded in chapter 5, verse 8. Again, typifying our Lord. For Christ taught as one having authority, and when he spoke, his opposition could not answer a word. We've considered his enemies, Nehemiah's. Three in total, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem the Arabian. We don't hear as much about. But the two principal and powerful enemies, the Moabite Sanballat and the Ammonite Tobiah, they used every deceitful tactic that they could muster, from threats of outright violence to offers of compromise. And if you continue your studies in 5 and 6, you'll see there were even open letters sent trying to entice, negotiate, and compromise with Nehemiah. As we read, they tried to draw him out to a place of meeting to do him harm or mischief, and all the while looked to influence every Israelite they could to turn in a divide-and-conquer strategy against Nehemiah's efforts, right up to the high priest himself. But Nehemiah, through the faith in his God, would thwart all of the wiles of the devil and in wise strategic determination keep Israel in a laser-focused action of work and building the walls. And what lessons for us to read and consider. Let's look at chapter 4 of Nehemiah and just read 13 through 18. Therefore said I in the lower places behind the wall and on the higher places, I even set the people after their families with their swords and their spears and their bows. Now today we do not arm ourselves with literal weapons of warfare. We are using the spiritual weapons of warfare that are prescribed to us, the sword of the Spirit. And I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people, be not ye afraid of them. Remember the Lord which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. Fight for your brethren and your families. That especially resonates to us in this day. And it also resonates, fight with your brethren. And it came to pass when our enemies heard it, that it was known unto us, and God had brought their counsel to naught, their evil attempts and tactics, that we returned all of us to the wall, every one unto his work. And it came to pass from that time forth that the half of my servants wrought in the work, and the other half of them had held both the spears, the shields, and the bows, and the harbergeons, and the rulers were behind all the house of Judah. And they which builded on the wall, and they that bare burdens, and those that laded every one with one of his hands, wrought in the work, and with the other hand held a weapon. For the builders, every one had his sword girded by his side, and so builded. And he that sounded the trumpet was by me. Now there's the most powerful implement of war, is the trumpet. And he was right by Nehemiah, for that would only be blown at the appropriate time, at the appropriate event, and that would call everybody to action. But we have an incredible lesson of simultaneous work efforts, watching or guarding and building. And because it's simultaneous, we must look at that and adopt it ourselves. Simultaneously on watch with our brethren, simultaneously engaged in the work, and not fearing, letting Yahweh provide the Elohim in their inexhaustible power as given to them by Yahweh to defend us. In chapter 7 through 12, we have the reconstituting of the nation, the re-registration of the remnant. Chapter 7 deals with the more practical and civil aspects of the reform, the restoration of the population, the appointment of the city officials, and basic measures for public safety. But we want to focus our attention for the last hour on the great work of chapter 8, in which Nehemiah brings forth the father of the nation, the scribe and the priest, dual competency, we might say, a scribe and a priest, the elder statesman, the perfect one for this event, the greatest student in Israel to open up the book of the law, Ezra, for the spiritual and moral rebuilding of the people. And we would remember, and we can, from our studies, this reading of the law, for many of them, they probably would be the first time that they would be hearing it. And we have to think how far back, how many of them really would have been left that would have heard it read before. It may have been possible that outside of Ezra, who may have been 90 to 100, his father was killed in the last invasion of Babylon. And so he may have been 10, may have been 15, 12, whatever, but you take the time of captivity and now he has returned, he's an old man. He may have been, in front of this group, the only one that was acquainted with the law of Moses, and so this would be a first reading for many, if not most, if not all, of the people. So, the last slide here. I found this helpful to illustrate the compromised position of Eliashib and, unfortunately, Meshullam, who was foremost in building the wall and put his hand. But as we see here, this is oftentimes the case of an entrenched enemy. They're not isolated and by themselves. They have relationships. They have influence. And the task is much more complicated, convoluted, and difficult. But you can see there, through marriage, a grandson of Eliashib, Manasseh, is married to the daughter of Sanballat. Berechiah, a priest, with Meshullam, so the granddaughter of Berechiah, is married to the son of Tobiah, who is married to the daughter of Shechaniah. And there is the challenge that Nehemiah had. These were not just isolated aliens trying to rule and influence in Israel. They were deeply entrenched in these relationships. So I believe we'll pause there for a break and then complete with our final hour.